Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 25th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. The son of late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi is among candidates disqualified for that country's December election.
He's back for Libya because he's going to bring back, if he were allowed to run, the same form of dictatorship and fake propaganda that his father used to control Libya for 40 years.
An Afrobarometer survey finds most Gambians' trust in their elections commission has declined. Why are more Liberian women clamoring to join the army? Tanzania reverses course to allow pregnant girls back in school. There is a scarcity of shelter for women suffering from gender-based violence in South Africa. And today is the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women.
It happens so sad that women still go back to their abusers. I wouldn't say majority of them, but some of the women would still go back to the abusers.
And a new cross-Atlantic mashup music from Guinea-Bissau. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. One of the sons of the late Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, Saif al-Islam Gaddafi, is among 25 candidates to be declared ineligible to run in Libya's December presidential election. Saif Gaddafi had been convicted in absentia for war crimes in 2015. About 98 Libyans are seeking the presidency, including the interim prime minister. Nizar Al-Sayah is professor emeritus of urban history at the University of California, Berkeley. He says Saif Gaddafi is bad for Libya because if he were to be allowed to run, he would bring back the same dictatorship like his late father.
I think the idea of whether he is qualified or not is always a political decision. So I would stick by my second part of my statement, which is the fact that he is definitely bad for Libya. He's bad for Libya because he's going to bring back, if he were allowed to run, the same form of dictatorship and fake propaganda that his father used to control Libya for a good 40 years. So as far as I'm concerned, I think this is very good for Libya. And in a sense, I think that there's definitely also a problem that disqualifying him may not necessarily create peace, because there are people who really want him there, very specific, you know, segments of the Libyan population and very specific tribes. So, you know, it is definitely a wise political decision. Whether it's going to bring about stability or not is something that we have to wait and see.
We have this Khalifa Haftar is also running. What do you make of that?
He's equally problematic because, in a sense, again, he represents very specific factions of eastern Libya. He's been supported mainly by Egypt, opposed by Turkey. Libya, unfortunately, is basically fighting ring in which many countries have used it, sometimes even legitimately, as a mechanism to defend their own borders or to spread very specific ideologies, imperial and otherwise. And in a sense, Haftar's history does not necessarily qualify him to continue to be considered. If Gaddafi's son was removed because he was Gaddafi's son and because of the previous aspects of the regime and because he was also wanted for crimes against humanity, I think the same applies, although not exactly for the same reasons, to Haftar, because in the end, assuming that he wins, which I doubt very much, that it will not bring about any kind of peace or stability in Libya. So in my opinion, actually, both are not necessarily good for Libya, and it would be good to see that both of them are not really being considered seriously.
We just heard Wednesday that the acting prime minister, I think his name is Mr. Abdul Hamid, has also announced he's running.
Yes, and I actually think that the more people of this sort who would run, the better. Although at the end, and as I told you before, I don't necessarily have that much expectation because in the first place, running a clean, really free democratic election in Libya under the current condition is not necessarily something that will happen easily. And assuming that it happens, the number of parties and tribes and even regions in Libya that would contest the result is still very, very high. It is, unfortunately, a formula that exists everywhere in the world right now where democracy is under threat and, in a sense, elections are not necessarily, the results of elections are not necessarily respected by those who lose. One can use the United States as an example. And as such, I absolutely expect that whatever the result of the Libyan election will be, it would be the same kind of stalemate that we have in other countries today about contesting the value of elections in the first place.
Professor, it's so nice to talk with you always. Thank you so much.
Thank you, James.
Nizar Al-Sayer is Professor Emeritus of Urban History at the University of California, Berkeley. A new survey by Afrobarometer finds most Gambians value elections as the best way to choose their leaders and that they are satisfied with the quality of their most recent elections. Gambians are going to the polls December 4th to choose a president. However, Afrobarometer says Gambians' trust in their country's independent electoral commission has declined, said Matty Jow, is the Afrobarometer appointment in the Gambia.
I think generally Gambians are very excited about this upcoming election. And as we can see, this is the first election in 20 years where we wouldn't have, you know, President Jammeh contesting as a candidate. And so this election is historical, but also, you know, based on our data, it shows that overwhelming majorities of Gambians believe that elections are the best way to choose a leader. And also they believe that their votes do count during elections. So I think this election is really exciting for many, and it's also seen as a very decisive election, particularly post-Jammeh.
You say in your survey that only about 49% of Gambians say that they trust the Independent Electoral Commission of Gambia. What does that mean? And how does that break down in terms of party and opposition supporters?
Our survey data shows that despite the general positive assessment on the electoral process, the trust in the Independent Electoral Commission, the IEC, has declined compared to 2018, where in 2018 you had 64% of the population trusting the commission. This recent survey shows that only 49% of the population trust them. And so, of course, in terms of ruling party opposition, we've seen that, and as expected, more people in the more supporters of the ruling party tend to trust the IEC more compared to those that are in the opposition.
Former President Yahya Jammeh has been in the news recently, particularly during the campaign period. Did you ask your survey participants about him, and what do they think about the former president?
Our survey data shows that 6 in 10 Gambians say that the government should seek the extradition of Jammeh, with 10 percentage point increase compared to 2018 survey, but also say that people or perpetrators of crimes and human rights violation under Jammeh should also face prosecution.
How large was your survey? I mean, how many people did you interview?
We interviewed 1,200 Gambians in January and February 2001.
Thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you for having me.
Said Matty Jow is Afrobarometer's point man in the Gambia. You're speaking with us from the capital, Banjul. Liberian women between the ages of 18 and 35 have lately been trumping at the country's Ministry of Defense to secure spaces ahead of the recruitment process for the armed forces of Liberia. As Rita Jalabwe reports from Monrovia, some of the women have been sleeping in the open outside the Ministry of Defense. They have vowed to remain there until the preparatory fitness exercise is over.
According to the Ministry of Defense, women who are participating in the pre-recruitment fitness exercise stand a chance of securing a space for the Armed Forces of Liberia recruitment that is expected to take place in mid-December. The preparatory fitness exercise started Monday, November 22. But women started congregating on Sunday, November 21, ahead of the exercise. Most of the women say they have been sleeping in the main street outside the Ministry of Defense and will continue to do so until the female pre-recruitment exercise is complete.
I'm here for the army training of the female. I'm a distant fire, so I came here Sunday coming to get space to enter. I've been sleeping right at the fence here because I don't have transportation to be going coming because of my distance.
The process started Monday, but because we live 5 places, so we are here Sunday to care space to the Maga Hotel. I've been lying right by the fence where you see me sitting.
Some of the women say they see the army recruitment as a way to get even with their male counterparts, an opportunity to contribute to nation building.
You know, many a time Liberian women just feel that they can't do anything. And so I just felt myself that I can do this. That's why encourage me to be a part of the SSR. We are not really here for money, but to serve our country, Mama Labio. So even I can be in the army for 5 months without taking pay, I won't mind.
I'm here to join the army because I believe that anything that men can do in this world,
for me, I have a passion for the AFL already, so I don't want to kill my dream.
Others say they see the army recruitment as an answer to their long-standing passion to serve their country, while others see it as a job opportunity for them.
I want to join the army because I'm tired passing on the streets. I'm tired. And if I get work to do, I will put my hands in something that will not make me to look fine. So I want to decide to join the army and to help myself.
Sam Collins is the Assistant Minister for Public Affairs at the Ministry of National Defense. When asked about the safety of the women sleeping in the open, Minister Collins says the recruitment did not require the women to do so.
When we say 5 in the morning or 6 in the morning, we mean that everybody competing for a space. So somebody would not want to pick up from Pearl River to come. So they were found the nearest place around the barracks. So we did not tell them to do so. But I think they want to be part of the system. So it was their own choosing.
Collins says the call for more females to join the AFL is aimed at meeting the United Nations requirement of women involvement in peacekeeping. According to him, the exercise seeks to recruit an additional 200 females into the Liberian Army. But he says the number of women trooping in for the exercise is 4 times more than the projected number. Rita Jrawe for VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 25th. Today is the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, and the United Nations says more than 650,000 women and girls were able to access gender-based violence services despite restrictions related to the pandemic. As Maureen Odhiambo reports from Milwaukee, USA, recent data from Kenya shows that about 41% of women reported having experienced physical or sexual violence from their husbands or partners.
The International Day for Elimination of Violence Against Women and Girls is observed on 25th of November, with domestic violence being identified as a global public health problem. The World Health Organization, WHO, estimates that almost 1/3 of women experience some form of physical or sexual violence from an intimate partner in their lifetime. WHO says at least 38% of all murders of women are committed by their intimate partners. A Kenyan, Florence Kea, who is also a survivor of gender-based violence, is running a safe house for women who undergo sexual violence. She says most women, despite being rescued, still go back to their abusive partners because most lack financial muscles.
I have done this for the last 6 years, rescue women and rescue girls who have gone through sexual violence. It happens so sad that women still go back to their abusers. I wouldn't say majority of them, but some of the women would still go back to the abusers. Economically, if you are not stable economically and you're going through violence, women sometimes look at their families and think that that man, as much as they abuse them, they'll still provide for their families.
Evelyn Boa from Agape Woman and Child Empowerment Foundation from Kibera Slums in Nairobi is addressing physical and sexual violence, which she says are on the rise in Kenya.
What we do, we normally have discussions that are geared towards encouraging women to speak out, but also we train them on how they can be agents of change in the community. And these women are survivors of different forms of violence, physical and sexual violence, which is on the rise. And this is affecting all women of reproductive age.
Violence against women and girls continue to be the most prevalent and pressing human rights issue in the world today. The executive director, UN Women, Sima Sami, said that More than 70% of women have experienced gender-based violence in crisis settings.
Violence against women is a global crisis. In all of our own neighborhoods, there are women and girls living in danger. Around the world, conflict and human rights violations are exacerbating violence against women. More than 70% of women have experienced gender-based violence.
The UN statistics show that in all corners of the world, helplines for violence against women saw an increase in reports. Ms. Sami says violence against women go unreported in many parts of the world.
In countries both rich and poor, gender prejudice has fueled acts of violence toward women and girls. Violence against women often goes unreported, silenced by stigma, shame, or fear of the perpetrators, and fear of a justice system that does not work for women.
WHO reports that across the world, 27% of women aged 15 to 49 years who have been in a relationship have been subjected to some form of physical or sexual violence by their intimate partners. Today, the International Day for Elimination of Violence Against Women also opens some hopes. It begins the annual 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence, a series of events aimed at creating real change. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
Tanzania has reversed course to allow pregnant students and adolescent mothers to attend school after having their babies. Neville Mina is secretary for Tanzania's Editors Forum.
Pressure from the public, from civil society, from different players, even from the donors or development partners. The red band in particular, that the school dropout, especially for girls, was very high. And the punishment chasing them out from the school was not acceptable. Actually, indeed, the government started this move a couple years ago and had a policy in place suggesting that these school girls should go back to school. And even before Magufuli died years ago, the then vice president, now who is the president right now, announced that the government will start re-enrolling the school girls who will be impregnated, so they should go and have their babies. And then after they give birth, they should come back to school. But 1 week after that announcement, the president came out and stated clearly that under his leadership, we should not allow anyone who got pregnant while schooling to go back to school.
To what degree do you think the lifting of this law has to do with the fact that Tanzania has a woman president?
Having Mama Samia or President Madam Samia in place as a president has its contribution on this particular decision.
What happened to the men who got the girls pregnant? Were these men ever punished?
The law punishes also the boys, not only the boys schooling, schoolboys, but also whoever caught having love affairs with a schoolgirl. If you found guilty, the penalty is 30 years in jail, like raping and so on. So it is very dangerous to engage in love with any schoolgirl or schoolboy in Tanzania.
Neville Mina is secretary for Tanzania's Editors Forum. He was speaking with us from the capital, Dar es Salaam. A report released yesterday by Human Rights Watch says many shelters for women suffering gender-based violence were extremely overwhelmed at the peak times of the coronavirus. The report shows a sharp increase in women requiring shelter, but some could not get it due to lockdown restrictions and movement. With South Africa facing high levels of gender-based violence, shelters have become a life-saving service for victims of gender-based violence. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
According to the report titled Sheltering Victims of Gender-Based Violence During South Africa's Pandemic, most shelters struggled to maintain social distancing as women sought protection. Some centers ran out of funds and struggled to reach women requiring help outside the shelters. Bernadine Baja from the National Shelter Movement of South Africa told reporters at the launch of the report that lockdown restrictions made it difficult for many vulnerable women to leave abusive situations.
I heard again and again that survivors were finding it very difficult to access domestic violence courts and police stations, that they were being restricted in when they could approach these institutions. We know that their services are still not survivor-centric, something that really needs to be given urgent attention to.
The research also shows that vulnerable groups such as sex workers, migrant women and lesbians, gay, bisexual and transgender, LGBT women were particularly vulnerable. Wendy Isaac, an LGBT researcher at Human Rights Watch, said some centers just lacked skills to deal with these groups.
Most of the shelters in South Africa provide support to primarily women, so they work in a very binary manner. So if you take, for instance, a transgender man, who has not gone through the entire transition, would they be able to access a woman's shelter or not? You know, these are some of the questions that have come up.
Women's rights activist Victor Matutu told VOA that migrant women who lost employment and could not be accommodated at the centers had to choose between being homeless or staying with their abusers.
And those who have abused them physically, they had the toughest time because during lockdown, they couldn't even go and report the perpetrators because everyone was meant to be in the house observing lockdown regulations. They couldn't even run to shelters to seek help because shelters were also not taking in more people due to the number of people that was allowed in a shelter at a time.
Cheryl Shabane, Center Operational Manager at Frida Hadley, told VOA that the situation continues and is getting worse for some women, despite COVID restriction levels easing.
Our economy has been hit very hard. So a lot of people have lost their jobs, having lost their homes and wanting a space to stay, trying to go and stay with family members also doesn't make sense because they're also trying to make ends meet. And some are forcing themselves to stay with their boyfriends, but things are not working out. So there's still a huge increase in women seeking shelter.
The report recommends more government funding to the shelters and training for social workers. It also calls for more focus on needs of vulnerable groups to ensure that the shelters can accommodate them. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In Zimbabwe, a former boxing champion is using his skills to teach the next generation and hopefully help keep impoverished young people away from drugs and crime. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
24-year-old Anton Possible Mapako was a street fighter and drug user from this poor suburb of Mbare. But he says things have changed since he joined the Mosquito Boxing School of Excellence. And he credits the school's founder and coach, Jenika Arifonso.
I always say thank you, coach, when I started to say this statement. Why? Because I know he's not just a teacher of boxing, but he can change even your mind about the bad things you think to do. He can change you.
44-year-old Alfonso started the academy after he left boxing. As a fighter, he was known as Mosquito for the way he would sting his opponents. Now his focus is on helping troubled youths.
I mean, this project, because I wanted to remove kids from drug abuse and womanizing and stealing, because there's a lot of crimes which are committed by these young guys.
Alfonso now has about 120 students divided into three groups per day. He hopes some become professional boxers. Zimbabwe government says substance abuse among youth is a scourge that needs to be addressed as soon as possible.
We are working with law enforcement agents to try and curb illicit substances coming into the country. And in terms of demand, we are working to try and educate members of the public around the dangers of engagement in illicit substance abuse.
Alfonso is working to set up programs in other poor townships and pull more youths away from drugs. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And that's it for this Thursday, November 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing that you will have a great day.